I'm Tom Hall, and this is Midday. On this archive edition of our program, it's Midday on Poetry. I'm joined by local poets who've made their mark on the national and international poetry scenes with award-winning verse from the classical mold to slam poetry. Elizabeth Spire's latest collection is called A Memory of the Future. Michael Collier's most recent book is called My Bishop and Other Poems. They'll read their work and share their perspective on poetry's power. Plus, we'll meet several members of the Do More Baltimore Poetry Team. They took home the top prize in this year's Brave New Voices International Poetry Slam competition. It's Midday on Poetry. Roses are red and other hues. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today it's Midday on Poetry. A little later in our show, we'll hear from four or five young Baltimore slam poets and their coach from the Do More Baltimore Youth Poetry Team, which won this year's 2018 Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Slam Festival. It's the second time in the last 3 years that they have won this award, so we will get a taste of their work and see why they are the champs. But first, we begin with two other champs, two great friends of ours who've been very, very significant folks on the poetry scene nationally and internationally. They're both here from Baltimore. Michael Collier has written numerous books of poetry over the past 40 years, including The Ledge. That was a finalist for the 2000 National Book Critics Circle Award. He served as Poet Laureate of Maryland from 2001 to 2004, and he stepped down just last year after more than two decades as director of the prestigious Breadloaf Writers Conference. He leads the creative writing program at the University of Maryland. His latest evocative and provocative collection, published by University of Chicago Press, is called My Bishop and Other Poems. Good to see you, sir.
Hey, Tom. Good to see you.
And Elizabeth Spires, she is here as well. Her new book is a searing collection of probing and poignant work. It's called A Memory of the Future. Elizabeth Spires is a professor of English at Goucher College, where she holds the chair for Distinguished Achievement. She's the author of seven collections of poetry and six critically acclaimed children's books as well. Beth, it's great to see you as well.
Good to see you, Tom.
You are welcome to be part of our conversation about poetry, the poetry of Mr. Collier and Ms. Spires, as well as perhaps your own poetry or poetry of some favorite poets. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wipr.org, to drop us a tweet, midday, at midday, rather, WIPR. And we are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So it's really great to see both of you, and congratulations. Both of these books are just terrific. I wonder, Beth, let me start with you. What do you think is different about this collection of work than the first or second or third collection you published, oh, a few years ago?
I thought you might ask me that, Tom. So I've been giving it. I think some of the poems, not all, they're getting shorter and simpler. It's kind of like if you had a room that was too crowded with furniture. That's kind of my psyche, perhaps. And just moving in this direction of trying to be very, very simple and concise, and also in a weird sort of way, not quite so autobiographical.
Mm-hmm. So some of your earlier work was a lot more sort of personal, you think?
Maybe so.
Yeah.
I don't think this book is impersonal, but it comes at it from a different direction.
And do you think there's a particular reason for that impulse to be perhaps a little less personal?
Well, let me put it this way. I think you think as you get older that life is going to, you're not going to juggle so much, but you're actually juggling more. So I think the impulse here is to get simpler.
Yeah, just keep it simple. Yeah. Michael, yeah. I mean, how about you? You guys have both been in the biz for a while. And there really is a difference, you know, as for a creative artist in his 60s or 70s than there is for a creative artist in his 20s or 30s.
Yeah, well, it's always desperation of some kind. Excuse me. And I was thinking, as Beth was talking about characterizing what's different about her work, I was thinking it's almost the opposite in this book of mine, because I always wrote fairly short lyric narrative poems, and this book is anchored by two long
Yeah.
Narrative poems that really are stories I had been trying to get at in poems for a long time. And so in some ways, there are a lot more words in this book as opposed to Bess, where she's getting rid of some of the furniture. I'm cluttering the rooms.
You're collecting
up,
more.
Yeah.
I basically think we're on the two different ends of a very good spectrum. You know, as long as you keep changing and evolving.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too, is being challenged. you don't always know how to challenge yourself.
Sure.
But the material quite often shows you the way. And I think that that's some of what's happened.
I hear writers, both prose and poets, prose writers and poets tell me that the material shows you the way. What do you mean by that? How does that happen?
Well, in, excuse me. In one of the poems, I'm trying to write about the aftermath of the Air Florida Flight 90 crash in the Potomac River.
In Washington, right. Mm-hmm.
And I had started
poem
to write
called
about
The Storm.
In The Storm. Mm-hmm. That's the name of the poem. And I tried to write about that many, many years ago. But I think the effect of that event hadn't ramified enough. And it wasn't really until 9/11, which was a kind of overarching disaster, that poem then became the poem about the Air Florida crash. Yeah. Somehow
and you always wanted to write about it as a poem rather than as some sort of prose, yeah, narrative, not
yes,
journalistic or anything.
Yes.
Beth, could you read one of the poems from the collection talking about this sort of simplification? You have one called Zen Sonnet.
Okay.
Which perhaps is you know, indicative of what you're talking about here.
I guess I should say that every spring, a spring workshop I teach, we read a book called The Zen of Creativity. It's just a very, one of my favorite books, really inspiring. The author's John Dado Laurie. And so this poem starts in the classroom, and it's called Zen Sonnet. Trying to combine two opposite things here, because I think of this kind of Zen as very free form and no rules, but yet sonnets have rules and structures.
So, yeah.
Zen Sonnet. It was April, and we were reading the book about Zen. You were writing your Zen poems, and we were talking about the moment we were in, and I was thinking thoughts that were not Zen, how I know too much, too little to teach you. And then I stepped back from each thought and watched it disappear, a horse without a rider, over a sharp-edged horizon. Spring was a pale shade of yellow, a green that kept deepening. There was desire and there was a sense of unfolding. And I thought, how we can do anything. There is no need for an excess of feeling. We can walk through the door that was made for entering and exiting, abandoning the poems that were never ours, though we wrote them, to the one who walks into this room when we are gone. So let us go out into the world and wander a little, beggars with empty bowls and straw hats, grass sandals.
Oh, it's a beautiful poem. I love that poem. And I'm taken by the line, how we can do anything. There is no need for an excess of feeling. What's the metric you use for sort of gauging and controlling the emotional punch of the poems you write? I mean, do you think about it in emotional terms? Do you think about how the words will strike the reader's ear or the reader's eye in an emotional way?
I think that's the first way to approach a poem. I don't mean it's the only way. I think as you initially approach a poem, it should affect you emotionally. And I always say to students, don't get me wrong, I don't encourage them to write sentimental poems, but I always say you have to take the chance or the risk of being emotional in a poem. You know, I'm not for only understating things. So this poem plays with the whole business of going right up to the edge of how much emotion can be allowed, but but not going over.
Yeah, and pulling it back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's an interesting notion, Michael, about how to read a poem. And you've done a lot of this. I mean, you were the poet laureate of the state for a while. You had a column in The Sun for a good bit, literally explaining poems and stuff. When you teach, you and Beth both teach young poets, aspiring poets and prose writers. What advice do you give them about how to encounter a poem? I guess maybe what I'm asking is, who's your ideal reader?
Well, I think, I don't know about the ideal reader, but reading a poem is a visceral experience. So the first thing you have to do is read it out loud and feel, not even really think about what it means, but feel it coming out of your body. That's really, really important. And not only for anybody who's just reading poetry, but it's especially important if you're trying to write poetry, because that's your, you have to be connected to it somehow through your body, and you have to hear it. if you can't, it's very, very difficult to then find syntax to carry and build and structure the rhythm of a poem. Yeah. And then the other thing is, look at the images and pay attention to the images. And don't try and interpret them so much, but let them open up and exfoliate, because quite often that's where the emotion comes from. It's not from a particular word, but it's from an image. So I'd say those two things are really important.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That's very interesting advice. Don't try to interpret them. Just, you got to first make sure you know what they are. I mean, you got to really envision them.
Right.
And you really think that it can only be envisioned if you're reading it out loud. So sitting by yourself in a room, reading it out loud.
I think it's the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a poet, I always tell student poets that when you're sitting and writing poems, you need to be reading it aloud as you're composing it. And then when you go back to revise, you have to start at the beginning and start reading it to get the kind of sonic thread. And that leads you back into the labyrinth of the poem.
Yeah.
And then you can find your way in revision.
Yeah. And Beth, as you well know, because we've known each other for 30 something years, you know, I'm a reformed classical musician, as a choral conductor. I dealt with texts all the time, and it fascinated me, the different powerful capacity, or capacity for power, that poems had when I read them to myself, when I read them out loud or heard them read out loud as a spoken poem, and when I interpreted the music that some composer had written to interpret and enliven and enlarge the music. They're three totally different experiences. And the musical one is, of course, a separate one. But, you know, what does music do to words? What does even background music do to words? I mean, there's just all sorts of things. If you're reading a poem and there's some, you know, Hearts of Space music going on in the back, it's a different experience than when you're reading a poem in a quiet room. But I wonder where that comes from. Why do our brains deal with these things differently in these different contexts?
Well, I think that reading a poem in a quiet room, assuming that your mind too is quiet, which it often is distracted, is
a good point.
Is one of the most powerful experiences a person can have. I brought a little quote because one of my poets that I have always admired and is Elizabeth Bishop, and she said, "What one seems to want in art, in experiencing it, is the same thing that is necessary for its creation, a self-forgetful, perfectly useless concentration."
Self-forgetful and perfectly useless. Concentration.
The only point of it is the actual activity of doing it without there being anything beyond that activity.
Yeah. I mean, do you have an ideal reader? Is that what the ideal reader is? That a person who can put herself in this quiet space mentally and emotionally and just breathe deep and encounter your
That would your be text? My ideal reader. And I also think that it's probably a mistake to, I mean, anyone can read however they want, but I think it's a mistake to try to read a book of poems in one sitting. I think that a person should read one or two or three poems with perfectly useless concentration, right?
Uh-huh.
Self-forgetful, useless concentration. and not read a book of poems the way you might read a novella or part of a novel.
Right, right. Interesting. I want to talk about that and how you decide the order that you put the poems in. Because if that's in fact true, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, you know, it's not like a CD, you know, an album that of course, now with people streaming things randomly, but a lot of folks, I know all the records I did, I thought very long and hard about the order of the songs, even the length of the spaces in between them. I mean, engineers and I used to argue for hours about, you know, should it be 2 seconds, 3 seconds? I mean, so all that kind of stuff. And right. How you put together a book, if it's not to be read all in one shot. That's fun.
Right.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about that. Elizabeth Spires, her latest collection of poems is called A Memory of the Future. She's on the faculty up at Goucher College. Michael Collier is a former poet laureate of Maryland who teaches in the creative writing program at the University of Maryland. His latest book is called My Bishop and Other Poems. More poetry with Michael Collier and Elizabeth Spires when we come back from a break. Coming up later, some slam poetry from members of a champion slam poetry team from Baltimore. You are welcome to join us with your questions and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To send us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, where you're listening to Midday.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's Midday at the Movies with Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday and the Maryland Film Festival's founding director, Jed Dietz. Plus, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will join us with her annual season preview. That's a look at some of the new productions coming up in the Baltimore, Washington area that have caught Judy's eye in particular. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. And coming up a little bit later today, some young Baltimore slam poets will give us a taste of their work, which garnered them a championship in an international poetry slam competition just a couple of months ago. But first, some more of the newly published poetry of Elizabeth Spires. Her new collection is called A Memory of the Future, and Michael Collier, his latest book is called My Bishop and Other Poems. If you've got questions or comments for Beth or Michael, our email 410, or our phone number, rather, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Michael Collier, as you mentioned, this book is anchored by two really long poems. One is called My Bishop, which is 22 pages long. The other, The Storm, 16-pager. And then there are some shorter ones. Let me ask you to read one of the shorter ones. Folks of Maryland, or fans of Maryland basketball, will remember the name Len Bias. This is a poem called Len Bias, A Bouquet of Flowers, and Miss Brooks.
Sure. And maybe I'll just say a couple things
sure.
about that first, and it is a short poem. But in 1986, in the spring of 1986, Gwendolyn Brooks, when she was a poet laureate, consultant to poetry at the Library of Congress, came to the University of Maryland to give a reading. And it was the same night of the basketball awards banquet. And Len Bias had been invited to come to the reading to give her a bouquet of flowers. And I was at that reading, and it was jammed packed.
And he, of course, was a star basketball.
He was
player.
A star. He'd already been. he was already an All-American. He would die in about 2 months. I think he died in middle of June, June 19th, 1986. So the poem tracks that event, but it's also a poem with a very particular form. It's called A Golden Shovel. And it's an acrostic that
that's a real thing.
It's a real
a
thing.
A golden shovel is the name of a real form of poetry.
Yeah, it's a new form.
Cool.
A terrific poet named Terence Hayes invented it. And it's called the Golden Shovel because it's a poem in homage to Gwendolyn Brooks and her famous poem, The Pool Players, Seven at the Golden Shovel. The Golden Shovel is the name of the pool hall. And the way it works is you take a line from a Gwendolyn Brooks poem or a stanza, and you parse it out at the end of each of your lines. So it's like it's an acrostic, but on the right-hand side. So the line I took, it was from the Ballad of Emmett Till of Gwendolyn Brooks. And the line that I took, I'll read it so you can hear it, goes this way. It's the last quatrain of the Ballad of Emmett Till. She kisses her killed boy, and she is sorry.
And so those words are the last words of each of the lines
of each of the lines
of these poems.
Yeah.
So of this poem.
So you'll be able to hear the end of the line by "She kisses her killed boy, and she is sorry." Len Bias, a bouquet of flowers, and Ms. Brooks. He arrives in the middle of her reading. She has to stop and, taking the flowers he's brought, kisses the beautiful young man whose yellow socks are her Dowdy's sweater's antithesis. What's said between them is killed by applause, but not his smile, which is the smile of a boy standing in the silence he's created, and not her magnified stare, which says, she understands why he's arrived late, is already leaving, and that he is sorry.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And it's even more, I was taken by it, having read it, not knowing any of the context that you've just given us, you know, this golden shovel.
Golden shovel, I know, it sounds
which
absurd.
I think you've made up. And I'm gullible enough to believe it, so I'm sticking with it.
No, there's a whole anthology of golden shovel poems.
And you're going to get it for Christmas.
That's right, yeah. I know it's under my tree. But you know, the context, I mean, Beth, you write in your book about a service at St. John the Divine, and there's a statue that is the sort of inspiration for one. And so it's important in some cases to know what's behind, the subtext, the context behind what's in a poem. But that's not readily available to the reader who just has the book, right?
Right. And I did something in this book that I had never done before, which was I've based other poems on images or paintings or photos, and I decided, hey, I would like people to see two of the images that I was thinking about when I wrote certain poems. So I had them reproduced in the back, not facing the poem, but
right.
in the back.
Yeah.
And I think I would probably do that again. It just had never occurred to me before. But I think that context is, you know, useful to the reader and may lead them to...
I mean, it's hard. You know, the music, classical music, faces this dilemma all the time as well. I mean, as a friend of mine once said, you know, you're not born loving Debussy. I mean, there's a certain level of understanding and a so-called appreciation for art music that it takes. It's different than listening to a pop song. Yeah. But you're not always, I mean, in a reading, you can, you know, you guys are doing a reading Friday night at the Ivy, you'll be able to explain each thing, and it certainly will enhance the experience. But your clues, you know, about taking stock of the images and, you know, being quiet with the poem and reading it out loud, those are really good ways to start. But I guess you can never go too far with the poem. you can get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, well, the poems can be... you know, they're like prayers in the sense that they can create a space that, as Beth said, you know, creates a deep meditation.
Yeah.
So, but then they do other things as well.
Michael Collier, his new book is called My Bishop and Other Poems. Elizabeth Spires, her new collection of poetry called A Memory of the Future. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We have a comment from Dave Eberhart, who is a poet himself, on Facebook. He says, where's the mystery, the magic, or music in American poetry these days? What about a poet like John Ashbery? He died about a year ago. Do either of you know this work? And what do you think? When Dave mentions the magic, the mystery, the magic, or the music in American poetry?
It's everywhere. I'm not sure if Dave doesn't find it in John Ashbery, but there's plenty of music and maybe even more mystery in Asbury. But I find it everywhere. You know, not all of our ears are tuned to all of the music, but I certainly don't think that there's a dearth of music in contemporary American poetry. And the young poets who are going to follow us are certainly going to have part of that music.
Sure, sure.
That's in America right now.
Yeah, Beth, I remember talking to Paul Muldoon a few years ago. He's the poet laureate of the United States for a while. He's at Princeton, I think. He's in a rock band and he writes songs, right? And your husband, Madison Bell, a great novelist, also writes songs. But you write poems instead of songs. I mean, and I talked to Paul about the difference between a lyric and a poem. And he said something that I really caught my interest. He said, poems have their own music. Lyrics need actual music. They need chords and melodies. But poems have their own music. But there is music seems to be the best metaphor for describing the flow of a poem, at least to me. Do you have a better one?
And different poems have different kinds of music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can be writing a metrical poem, a very, very rhythmical poem, a poem where the rhyming, you can hear it. And other poems have, like Asbury's poems, maybe some people would say they're not musical, but they have a different kind of music that's prose. You can be writing prose and there can be a music within those words. And I've even played at times, I don't do it often, how prosy can I make something and have it still be a poem? And that's just because I like to do different kinds of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Michael, both of you, some of your poems, when you look at them on the page, they look like paragraphs of prose. They don't look like what we think of as so quote-unquote traditional poems.
Right.
Yeah, that's purposeful. How the poem looks on the page when it's typeset in the book matters a lot, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, it does. And part of the problem I had with those longer poems was to figure out what shape they should be on the page. And one of them is very odd. And the other looks more like a poem. The other looks more like prose with long lines hanging over paragraphs or something like that. But in this book, too, I have a few prose poems. And those are prose poems because I just couldn't get them to behave as lyrically as I wanted them to. But there's plenty of music in them.
Sure.
There's plenty of internal rhyme and alliteration.
What can you tell us about the title poem of the book, My Bishop? So this is a long poem, as I said, 22 pages. But again, some of those pages have like two lines on it, and others have more.
Well,
it's about a very, deeply poignant thing and very topical. It's about, child abuse in the Catholic Church.
Well, it's about a friendship that I had with Bishop of Phoenix when I was, he wasn't a bishop at the time, but he was an associate pastor at the church I went to. And it's about and then eventually he became convicted of manslaughter for hitting someone and leaving the scene, hit and run. And he was also one of these bishops who moved around pedophile priests. And one of those priests was at my parish as well. And so it's really, the poem's not so much about child abuse, but it's about this complicated, difficult friendship over the years that I had with this bishop who you could just plug him in for all the bishops.
He is every man when it comes to bishops.
So that's part
these
of
days.
Yeah. That's part of what it's about.
Yeah, and again, it's just horribly oversimplifying to say, oh, it's about child abuse,
but it's definitely
part of it.
It's definitely in the middle of it. There's tons of recognizable events in that poem.
Yeah, Beth, let me ask you to read your title poem in this collection, A Memory of the Future. And again, I'm always fascinated about like where the title poem ends up, and your title poem is like, towards the end of the book.
Yeah, well, sometimes my title poem is earlier, but this one, A Memory of the Future, is towards the end of the book. And I was really thinking about people that I've been very close to who, as they got older, began to lose their memory. And then, piece by piece, not suddenly. And then, of course, I started to think, this, it could happen to any of us. So this is a poem about that loss of memory spoken maybe by, well, I don't know if it's my future self or somebody, a memory of the future. I will say tree, not pine tree. I will say flower, not forsythia. I will see birds, many birds, flying in four directions. Then rock and cloud will be lost. Spring will be lost. And most terribly, your name will be lost. I will revel in a world no longer particular, a world made vague as if by fog, but not fog. Vaguely aware, I will wander at will. I will wade deeper into wide water. You'll see me there, out by the horizon, an old gray thing who finally knows gray is the most beautiful color.
Who finally knows gray is the most beautiful color. Oh, that's great. Michael, we just have a couple minutes left. Can I ask you to read one more? You write a few poems about your father.
Right.
And I was taken in particular by one call, on page 71 called My Father as a Maple Tree.
Sure.
My father is a maple tree. As large as a one-footed elephant, its several trunks and tusks bent landward, leafed and petaled. And in its 100, 200 years of age, bowed not by kneeling on that leg, but by the troubling weight of wind and its own heavy, splintered crown, while a great palmetto ear, like a burned-out sponge, lay on the ground. That's how he looked this morning, a thrashing, fissured monument pecked by birds that nominate his skin. A boundary tree cleaved by lightning, lost to what it bound. Jesus Christ, a neighbor urged, cut it down.
Boy, that just goes right to you. I cried when I read it. I'm crying now. I mean, it's so beautiful in so many ways. Let me go back to a question I raised in the first segment. How do you order the poems in the book? Do you and your editor, you know, hash this out, argued, or do you just say to her, this is how it's going to be, or how does it work?
I've never had an editor suggest ordering. I've always presented the manuscript ordered, and sometimes I've made small changes. I think you have to think about if you're taking, I know this is a strange way to describe it, but what a poem is next to is really important. So you bring out things in poems by what is next to them in terms of some sort of image or motif, something you're picking up on. And it could be like a group photo where someone would look shorter if they were next to two people taller. Do you want that? If you see my analogy. So I group the poems in terms of sequence, in terms of preoccupation or obsession.
Yeah, and, Michael, is it kind of like a museum, you know, where you hang paintings in a way that juxtaposes
maybe
this image to that image?
I one of the things I do is try and do something that's counterintuitive and put poems together that don't seem to go together and see what happens with that. That's not the only way I do it, but sometimes there'll be, frission between the two. So that's one way to create tension between the work as well.
Well, this is beautiful work, worth reading and rereading and thinking about and being calm with and being provoked by. And so congratulations to both of you. You guys are going to be at the Ivy Bookshop on Friday night, and I'm going to be there with Linnell, and we are looking forward to it.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah,
good
thanks
to see
for
you
having
both.
Us.
Michael Collier, he's the former Poet Laureate of Maryland who teaches in the Creative Writing Program at the University of Maryland. His latest book is called My Bishop and Other Poems. Elizabeth Spires, her latest collection is called A Memory of the Future. She's on the faculty at Goucher College.
College. You can hear more from Elizabeth Spires and Michael Collier, as I said, Friday night, Ivy Bookshop right here in Baltimore. They're giving a reading, taking questions at the Ivy beginning at 7 o'clock, and we've got a link to all the details of that event at wypr.org/midday. Coming up, more poetry here on Midday, the Do More Baltimore Youth Poetry Team. They have won the 2018 Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Slam Festival in Houston. It was their second win at that competition in 3 years, and they'll join me here in Studio A to give us a little taste of their work when we come back from a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Midday on Poetry continues now with some champion slam poets. I'm joined in the studio by members of the Do More Baltimore Youth Poetry Team. The team is fresh from their win this past July at the Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Slam Festival. It was held in Houston. It was Do More Baltimore's second win in 3 years at that prestigious contest. Every year, 500 young poets from around the world compete for 5 days of artistic education and expression, and they get together and enjoy themselves. So I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourself. Let me start with Ajayo. You just go down the line here and tell us who you are.
My name is Ajua Bedu. I'm 16 years old. I go to Towson High School, and this is my first year as a part of the team, and probably like my favorite year out of my 16 years of living.
Good. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Kima Flight. I'm 17. I go to Weston High School, and this is also my first year of being a part of the Do More Poetry Team. And yeah, that's it.
Welcome. Good to see you, Kima.
Hi, my name is Kraleani Lee Connor. I graduated from Woodlawn High School. I'm 19, and this is my third and last year on the team.
Welcome.
Hi, my name is Delicia Green. I also go by London Obsidian. This is my second year being on the team. I also graduated from Woodlawn High School, and I love it.
Hello, my name is Maren, a.k.a. Lovey Wright Kerr. I'm a senior at Carver Center for Arts and Technology, and this is my second year on the team. Yeah.
Great, welcome. And the coach is here, too.
Hi, my name is Slankston Hughes. I'm the artistic director for Do More Baltimore, and I'm also the coach of the Baltimore City Youth Poetry Team.
Well, welcome to everybody. So let's hear a poem. What do you guys want to start with?
All right, so first we're going to start off with a poem called Libyan Letter.
Libyan Letter.
Yes. Wafaniko. 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 Eurade. Wafaniko. October 31st. Dear God, this can't keep happening. Been hung in chains so many times, but never high enough to reach you. But it seems like even you can't stop the madness in this world.
Our brains is a target for Master Sick Games. They call it operation. And even though he has not touched me, it feels as if my vocal cords have been ripped from my throat like surgery. Feels as if I am under anesthesia,
constantly numb to the ropes and whiffs. A gift would be to feel my soul again, tie us up like presents to present to their family, just objects to be bought and sold till there's no more value left, and we got no values left. Running for my life just to steal a piece of bread for my babes. Let white men strip me on the stand while my husband watched just to keep the churn safe.
Leaving mothers, fathers, daughters, arms grasping to get in boats as if their lives aren't worth a second trip.
We tripping over sticks and stones as if massa won't break our bones when they catch us. Sending dogs and guns like nigger catching is a sport. April 4th.
God in heaven, we have to get a boat.
Not a chance in hell our steps on a boat again. They sail us by the harbor here in Baltimore.
In Libya, they smuggle our bodies by the seashore.
Our lives hanging in the balance of the water. We ain't ever gonna know where the ways is taking us, but they keep finding value in the vulnerable.
Picking apart Africa like vultures do corpses, except they don't know how much the motherland cradles us, how rich she is.
And they claiming her as an exclusive possession, gentrifying gold to dirt.
Boardwalks to us is just walking the plank.
And somehow white allies wear eye patches on both eyes. Either you are too God or you must be blind. This hatred been happening forever. Old America.
To new Africa. This Libyan's letter was written eons before my birth.
Slave narratives are more like motif than myth. The same repeating theme. Dear God, it's June 19th, yet we still ain't free. There are no more waters left to wade in. These tides and these tears have dried on their own. Black holes have been explored better than black souls, because white stars take the light we once had and make us nothing. How can we forget our history?
When they are current events.
It was 1808.
It's 2018.
God, I guess the message missed you, but we'll keep leaving them.
Wait in water.
Wafranico.
Wait in water.
Wafranico.
God's gonna trouble the water.
Bravo, that's beautiful. That is so beautiful. Libyan Letter, that's Kima Flight and Achu Baidu, members of the Dumore Baltimore Youth Poetry Team. So, Slice and Hughes, when you put these groups together, how do you go about deciding whether this should be a two-person poem, a three-person poem? Are the writers of the poems always the performers of the poems? How does the process evolve?
Well, writing-wise, especially with this year's team, they kind of came up with concepts collectively and then also wrote collectively. And the person who come up with the concept is not necessarily always in the poem. And the writing is kind of a shared experience. Most of the pieces have at least four people in them. That was actually the only one from this year that had only two, because this team is really tight-knit from a writing standpoint. And the concepts typically come first, and then we say who is best and more comfortable writing to what concepts, and then figure out who's going to write to what from that point. But the concepts kind of come first.
Yeah, but the connection between you two, and for the folks who are watching this on Facebook, they can clearly see it. But I bet even if you're listening on the radio at home, you close your eyes and you can feel the intense connection. This is about community, it seems, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
In a lot of ways. Well, let's have another one. What else can you... You got another one waiting for us.
This is Wildfire, and it's kind of a retrospective on a lot of the social justice issues going on in America with police brutality and black people and black communities, as well as kind of if the energy of the Baltimore uprising following Freddie Gray's death at the hands of the police could kind of embody itself in the fire that happened during that week, if that fire could speak in the form of a poem. It's called Wildfire.
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 After the verdicts.
Wallet.
Holding a toy gun.
Loose cigarettes.
Legal firearm. Failing to signal at a lane change.
Selling CDs.
Running.
Breathing.
Existing.
Crazy how you know what this piece is about. Before we even said any names. How you know autopsy before autobiography. No death before deliverance. The fire is rising.
No matter how many videos they view, white people won't change their views.
Guess the only views black people can have are at a funeral.
Can't sell CDs without recording the soundtrack to Black Death. Don't have to smoke cigarettes to have them kill you.
Can't play with a toy gun when you're old enough to be shot by a real one. Tamir Rice, age 12. Forward authored by 12 bullets. His story lived longer than he did.
The fire is rising, and no amount of tears can bring them back.
And no amount of voices can give them back. We give our 2 cents, police rob us of our innocence, so that's why we have to watch what we say.
The fire will speak for us. Philando Castile's daughter won't know justice in exchange for her trauma. Instead of daddy-daughter dances,
she will waltz with the memory of her father, who once was haunted by gavels that sing out acquittals rather than and accountability.
Her mother's tears burning in our hearts.
Richard Collins III was a soon-to-be Bowie graduate who was fatally stabbed by a racist white man.
I guess college don't really save niggas. There is no way to survive America when prejudice is in every board meeting, revolution in our DNA. All we know is how to fight in a dark world that hates dark skin. This fire in my throat is the light, and it's mine.
Tired of you stealing our sons. Ironic, white people are the black hole sucking up all the light.
Black people can't have nothing ourselves. Not our property, not our culture.
Not our freedom, not our lives, not even our deaths. We coming for you. But since black skin will make you a threat in the flesh, this a promise, and no change will change our body's currency. So currently, we're bankrupt on F's to give.
Hate that whites are getting cheese off our bodies, so we load up the Mac and fill them with shells.
Remember what we said last time? This is what happens when the youth fire is back. Well, this fire is black, F a white ally. This black fire gonna burn the white lies and slide through your non-existent lips.
I for protest, we done with this ish. The unrest has reached its peak in Baltimore. We don't just speak with heat, we let that ish burn.
We're gonna find you and burn your city down.
Wildfire!
Beautiful. The intrinsic passion and energy and rage is so compelling, and it's so difficult to communicate, I would imagine, on a certain level, right? I mean, how do you coach the team to communicate in such a visceral and, you know, believable, plausible, powerful way?
Well, it's interesting. Whenever you traditionally talk about the canon of black poetry, especially in America, when you go all the way back to the Black Arts Movement and Black Renaissance, what often gets attached to it in description is the rage, the anger, the rage, like the black rage. And it's almost like surprise that there's this kind of metaphorical fire in the work and in the writing. But if you look at the social issues throughout time and the actual content that it's pulling from in the country, it shouldn't be a surprise that this is in the work, because it's like, how else do you process these things in a way that's more constructive and productive than literally burning cities down? So sometimes you have to set fire to a page. And so we don't have to coach the visual aspect of what's verbal. Mm-hmm. That's coming from a very real place and reflective in what's actually happening. The art is a mirror to the reality. It's more about doing it in a way that's effectively communicating the message and in a way that will make people stop and think. And sometimes it's easier to grab and shake people to get them to pay attention than it is to whisper at them. It's very interesting how when you look around the country, a lot of the police brutality cases, Baltimore was the only place that actually got charges towards officers.
Yeah.
And it also was the only place where buildings were set on fire. And there was actually a grant for our summer writing institute that we've been doing for 4 years now that we were not going to get it first. And then the uprising happened, and all of a sudden they called us back and said, we think maybe we do need a poetry summer program for some of the youth in Baltimore, because maybe that'll provide a better outlet.
And you got a championship team when you put it together. Yeah, congratulations. Go to Houston, Texas, 500 folks from all over the world. This is international. It's not just folks in the U.S. This is all over the world. Well, thank you guys for coming by. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate it. This is the DuMore Baltimore Youth Poetry Team. They team won the 2018 Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Slam Festival in Houston this past July. Their second win in 3 years, so go for another one next year.
Thank you guys.
All right, that's it for us today. Tomorrow it's Midday at the Movies with our movie mavens, Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday and Maryland Film Festival founding director Jed Dietz, plus theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us for a season preview of what we have to look forward to in local theaters. That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Midday. Stay tuned for Life in the Balance. That's coming right up after the NPR newscast at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Go do more. Have a great day.
Thank you.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.